Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. .podbean.com.
Seven stranded human beings, the Galileo Seven, a dog called Chipper, and the date June 12th, 1983. Just four ingredients of this week's Resonance Rewind. Start by quoting from Robin Pierce's friend Gary Guarani and his text Fantastic Television, which I'm holding up to the microphone at this particular moment in time. We have a launch which says The Crash, first season episode, in fact, he did pilot of Land of the Giants. Pilot Steve Burton and Dan Erickson struggle to control their London-bound spaceship after it passes through a mysterious cloud. The passengers and crew discover that they have landed in a world of fantastic proportions. A giant cat, an automobile. I thought I'd save you the trouble of summing it up, Robin, for a certain extent, but perhaps you'd like to share with us your own take on this Owen Allen final part of his quartet of a series in the 1960s which paved the way for so much fantasy world and so on.
Well, I was a big Irwin Allen fan in the 60s, of course. This follows the suborbital flight 612 from Los Angeles to London. They encounter a magnetic storm. They crash on a planet where everything's 12 times bigger. It's set 15 years in future of the time it was made, so 1983. It has very late 60s sensibilities. The planet resembles 1968 America, but several future episodes would suggest an authoritarian government and there's a secret police, Special Investigations Department. We find out that several other flights, six in all, have landed there previously. But for the crash, you've got high production values. It's like a mini sci-fi movie. They crash on this unknown planet. There's some tentative exploration and encounters with giants. They are almost run over by a giant automobile. A child picks up a spaceship and starts rocking it around. So we get the old sea view rock and roll from Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. A cat attacks. There's a... Nice one, Alex. There's a terrible blue screen tarantula spider, which is incredible given the high production values of the overall production, which at the time was the most expensive TV show ever produced at $250,000 per episode. But it has problems. Do I go into those now?
No, we want to be positive about this. We want to work our way through that. And for a long time, I tended to share the views of many Star Trek fans who thought, Owen Allen is an insult to science and all manner of challenges on that basis. Let's introduce folk who effectively might have encountered Land of the Giants for the first ever time. And interesting enough, little fun fact, Owen Allen was born the same year as Olivia de Havilland, of course, who recently passed away, aged 104. So had Owen actually lived, he would have been 104 years of age. He actually died in 1991, literally just a week after Gene Roddenberry. There's a spooky coincidence. Gene Roddenberry and Irwin Allen popping their clogs, transcending, moving up to another level within a final week of the whole system. And like, of course, Gerry Anderson, he liked to direct his first pilots. But let's talk to Jessica Burtis. Jessica, Land of the Giants. Were your parents familiar with this? Did they say, what are they introducing you on that show to? You should have stuck with Star Trek.
My mom had, well, my dad thought I was watching Star Trek, but my mom had never actually heard of the show. So I'll have to give her a review later. It was very good, actually. I was very impressed with how high quality the animation and everything was for the 60s. It was very impressive.
Okay, excellent. That's good from there. What did you make of the characters? Because, again, you've got the Magnificent Seven there, the dog called Chipper, who seems to me to actually be physically attached to Barry for much of the series. I thought, has Chipper got no legs? Is he just, I mean, he does finally run around later, but for a long time he's sort of, and he looks fairly cheesed off as well. It's almost as though I'll kill my agent for actually getting me this particular role, but what the heck? I'm in a child's arms for most of the time. Alexander Fitzhugh, the lovable rogue, which suggested it was, oh, it's like Lost in Space again. You've got Zachary Smith and young accomplice Will Robinson as well. You have, of course, the stewardess, of course, who likes to put her passengers at ease, although one might say that surely they might have, even the 1980s, realised the importance of fixing the seats to the floor so they don't actually slide around the compartment, particularly if you've got a suborbital flight. Look what happened to the Space Shuttle Challenger. I rest my case. And of course, you got the wonderful battle for the alpha males between Steve Burton and Mark, the engineer Mark Wilson, played, of course, by Gary Conway, and I think Don Matheson, who portrayed the Mark. And of course, the co-pilot as well, a multiracial cast, which is, you know, at that stage, Don Marshall, one of only three major leads, the others being Nichelle Nichols in Star Trek, Lieutenant Uhura, and of course, Greg Morris in Mission Impossible. Actually, Bill Cosby was also an I Spy. Were those things which you kind of thought, oh, that's interesting, or did you, as a viewer in the 21st century, did you think the situation normal there?
Yeah, I think with the last point about there being a more diverse cast, I actually didn't. It just seemed normal to me. So I kind of didn't understand the novelty of what that must have been like in the context of the 60s. But I remember when I was watching it, there were so many characters. I was kind of having trouble at first, like trying to figure out who was who a little bit. But I think with being like someone from the 21st century, it is a bit different watching it.
Oh, yeah. As I say, what might have been, we didn't get suborbital flights, and clearly for the people who are actually wanting for one universe, this was taking place 3 years after UFO was supposed to take place. But that's another show for another time and another era. Poppy, let's turn to you, because I know whenever you look at the screen and you see the sinusoidal wave function, you think, how can they possibly tell there are two giants or a cat walking to the actual spaceship, just about waves and lots of blinking lights, which for many of us, all you needed in the future to signify the future was a silvery suit and blinking lights.
Yeah, well, I watched it with my mum, actually, and neither of us had ever seen it. So we were, it was quite entertaining, some of the things that they saw as futuristic. You know, they were kind of, had the walkie-talkie, which was like a futuristic idea, but then it had that massive antenna on it still. So they hadn't quite gotten rid of that in the future, and all those kind of small things that just made it quite a funny watch, I think. I did enjoy it, actually. I think it was very good.
Well, 51 shows in the series. We might go on to consider another one. Jenny Bill, did you watch it with your father? And did the Reverend Bill turn around and say, you'll be damned in hell, in Hades, for watching Irwin Allen? Jenny, what's going on? And by the way, you'll need to unmute yourself, otherwise we won't hear a darn thing you're saying. So just make sure that's that sort of through, passing the word through there.
No, I didn't watch it with my dad. He wasn't really very interested in it. I have, of course, seen it before. Not one of my favourite 1960s cult TV shows, but the thing that, when watching it again, that really stood out to me was at the beginning when it said it's 1983, and I thought, what on earth possessed them to set it in 1983 when it was clearly meant to be so far advanced of the 1960s? Good acting. I thought the sets were very good, apart from yeah, the spider and the cat, they obviously didn't look real, but I thought the actual sets that they had built looked fantastic, and it looked really great.
You see, in many ways, the metaphor of actually escaping from the bearded giant, who, I'll be honest, looks too much like Rolf Harris to make me feel at all comfortable. And I thought for years, there is a line there. Again, for Poppy and Jess, if you're not familiar with the unfortunate demise of that particular individual, just think Harvey Weinstein with a beard. But in terms of, and Australian, but in terms of that, certainly the only thing, and I think we see there in terms of the Land of Giants annual, sort of the notion there of mini people, playthings in a world of giant tementos. And just when you think you've actually escaped that whole thing, you end up in a garbage dump attacked by a giant dog. It's just, you know, in an egg carton. I mean, this is my life. Robin, has that sort of given you a few sort of pointers to go through? Because I've got a Land of the Giants quiz on the characters for all of us to take part in a few moments.
A very interesting points. And as ever, I have notes.
And I've got the annual.
I used to have that. The problems, I think, the recurring cast is too big. There are several characters that could be either amalgamated or they could be just lost altogether. And one of them did get lost for a little while, but that's
because she was having a baby. Second. Heather Young, well, she was not obviously in the series, externally.
We've got three action heroes in Steve Burton, the All-American pilot. We've got Don Marshall, the engineer. We've got Dan Erickson, the co-pilot. And you don't really need three. You could have got on with two. Because Steve Burton is the star, so he's going to be in every episode. It left the other two vying a little bit for the number two spot. And quite often, it was pilot Dan Erickson who got left behind. Valerie Scott, the rich girl, is literally just there to be rescued. She has no other purpose. Orphan Barry Lockridge, he's just there to get in trouble with Alexander Fitzhugh, who is a clone of Lost in Space's Zachary Smith.
You're as bright as a button, Robin.
But he's an interfering bad guy you'll love to hate, but he hasn't got Jonathan Harris's charm. That leaves us with Heather Young as stewardess Betty Hamilton, whose only purpose in the entire run of the show is to make coffee and fret whether the menfolk will get back safely. She has no other purpose. I mean, how demeaning is that? It's Lost in Space on a planet of the apes with a beefed up flying sub for a ship that's been repainted orange. The cast replicates the Robinson roles. Betty is very much Mother Maureen Robinson, who likewise, throughout three seasons, never had her own adventure. I mean, she was just there to basically, you know, worry, fret, and make coffee and make sure that the menfolk were well fed. I mean, it shows in comparison how far ahead in gender roles Star Trek was, even though we've touched on that previously, and that was by no means perfect, but this was very much 60s misogynism, and, you know, we'll keep the women barefoot and pregnant in a hat.
I honestly thought, Robin, as you put forward the episode, The Crash and Land of the Giants, in this whole system, as we were looking for the kind of running order, you might have been a bit more positive about the series, but, you know,
well, I've never got... Itself, I like The Crash. It's my favourite of all of the, I won't say Gary Anderson, Irwin Allen pilots. I think it's a stronger pilot than the Lost in Space, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and even Time Tunnel. But, you know, if you've seen The Crash, you've basically seen over three quarters of the episodes they ever produced, as most of them are escape capers involving sewing thread ropes and little safety pins or grapple hooks.
What's not to appreciate about that? I mean, it paved the way for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Honey, I Blew Up the Baby.
But they were over in about an hour and a half. This went on for over 50 hours.
51 episodes, and Irwin Allen obviously moved on to become Master of Disaster, or at least have the image of Master of Disaster. Jessica, harsh words there, I felt, from Robin. I mean, would you come back? I mean, Deanna Lund, who sadly passed away a wee while ago, actually, this year, I believe. I think she said it as Valerie Scott, she got better as the series progressed. There were moments where you almost want to say, certainly in the episode The Crash, when she decides to quite happily step into the scientist's cage trap, despite being warned by Steve Burton not to do that. And then Steve, again, sort of thinking, what do you think, Steve? Why do you have to step in to actually work that? And then the cage comes out. There are moments like that. How did you feel about that? Because I'm thinking in many ways, you know, Poppy and Jess could actually be our Betty and Valerie of the remake of Land of the Giants, and Jenny would obviously be one of the scientists sort of experimenting, you know, in some crazed way on the whole sort of thing.
I did notice, I liked the show, but I am finding myself agreeing a little bit with a lot of things that Robin was saying. I think watching it, I did notice that the male characters seem to have a bit more of a developed storyline already, but I figured that maybe with the female characters it would get a bit better as the series progressed. So it's a bit disheartening hearing that it might not, but yeah, I thought that the stewardess, it kind of seemed like her whole like role in the first episode was screaming during the crash, and but yeah, I was hoping it would change this as the series went on.
Well, I mean, there are sort of areas that I wouldn't necessarily say, but a couple of areas which I think do work quite nicely in Ghost Town. And I think certainly Anthony Wilson, who was responsible for writing this particular episode, did actually create good characters. They were well-rounded characters. It's often said that the series lost it a little bit when Anthony Wilson left the series and they become more sort of ciphers on the whole thing. Poppy, philosophically speaking, does this sort of raise issues related to humanity viewing ourselves as circumstances beyond our control? Because, I mean, you're too young to remember The Towering Inferno, lots of other sort of Swarm, Owen Allen going big screen with disasters and disaster movies and so on. Anything spring to mind from your own point of view?
Philosophically, there was not anything really springing to mind when I was watching it. I was quite distracted by the various giant cats and dogs and stuff. I think there was more of an issue. Well, one thing that I was really frustrated with, almost shouting at the screen, was that both the giants and the characters spoke English. And I feel like they could have really communicated a bit better in that laboratory. So I just don't know why they didn't just, you know, say, can you not experiment on us, please? You know, we speak the same language, we can communicate.
This iconic scene, which I'm holding up now, of obviously Steve Burton and Valerie Scott, Gary Conway and Deanna Lund, actually being stuck down by sellotape whilst a pencil eraser. I don't know what the purpose, I mean, you know, I thought for years when I was doing biology at a degree level and so on, and it still bemused me. I mean, I did my fair share, admittedly, before anti-vivisectionists started, so we actually no longer actually cut up rats and so on, so I did my various other sort of aspects, and never in any of those experiments did I ever actually just use a pencil with an eraser on the end to actually poke at a particular thing and then actually hear the screams. I just couldn't quite work that out, but maybe that's the science side of things. Jenny, I mean, your thoughts, I mean, is this something where you thought, well, it was fun, you know, take it on the basis of it's a fun episode with traditional square-jawed American heroes with the family effectively transported into a strange world of, as we said, giant dementors in a kind of 1930s police state. And don't get me started on Inspector Kobik, who I always found was perhaps used a bit too frequently, even though Kevin Hagen had a brave input as the police chief inspector.
Yes, I just took it as a bit of fun. As I said, I think you have to put aside the science, really, when you watch this sort of thing. and the timeline and just enjoy it for what it is. I do agree with the things that Robin said about the characters. I thought they were quite predictable, and I don't think the storylines in the series are great, but I do think the sets were one of the standout things, and they made an effort to be a bit different.
And also, Robin, don't forget the classic episode where Betty Hamilton actually is a marionette and performs for people. So, you know, that's another line.
Just as woodenly as usual. If I can just tell our panel one thing about actress Heather Young. She became pregnant while they were filming the second season. Mm-hmm. And for a while, they replaced her uniform with a baggier one, and they started then just filming her from the waist up. Well, eventually, as the pregnancy was moving along and the baby arrived, she was written out of several episodes, about six or eight, and she just wasn't there, wasn't mentioned. Nobody missed her. Nobody missed her. That alone just shows what a useless character she was. I mean, probably a very nice lady, but what a useless character.
Robin, I would actually sort of say the similar thing happened with Gillian Anderson and the X-Files in the 1990s, and you know, so
well,
I think
at least she was there.
Let's move on to the little quiz that we've actually put together. I thought it's too good to actually do this. So these are all clues that actually identify one of the characters in Land of the Giants. And I think we'll actually signify the whole thing by... I might just sort of select an individual to go for this, and then we'll open it up. We'll start off with Poppy. So your clue, Poppy, is a light tackle formed by two or three blocks of pulleys. A light tackle formed by two or three blocks of pulleys. Which character does that signify?
God, this is so cryptic. I don't know. I feel like I don't even remember anyone's names at this point.
Oh.
The dog? I don't know. I feel like I want it to be the dog. That's...
Sadly, the dog is an incorrect answer. Jess?
I kind of agree with Poppy that I had a hard time remembering their names.
Okay. This is also confirming my days that back in the day, youngsters were actually exercised their mind a lot more than the internet in terms of characters from that point of view. Jenny, any thoughts?
Oh, I need the clue again. I can't even remember
the clue. A light tackle formed by two or three blocks of pulleys.
Oh, is it the lead gentleman whose name I can't remember?
It is indeed Steve Burton. Burton, of course, being a light tackle. So Burton that, as in gone for Burton and so on. Next one. Robin, you're up for this one. German money.
Oh, Mark Wilson.
Absolutely. Robin sort of just sneezed us into that routine. Back with yourself, Poppy. A small boy used, that's boy as in B-U-O-Y, used as a mark in deep sea fishing. A small boy used as a mark in deep sea fishing.
I feel like these are word clues pointing to words that are just not in my vocabulary. So I don't know. Is it just the small boy, the boy? I'm just
no.
going.
No. So we turn to Jess.
Oh, no. What was it? A small boy?
A small boy used as a mark in deep sea fishing. Small boy used as a mark in deep sea fishing.
A mark? A small boy? B-O-Y?
Yeah, B-U-O-Y.
Oh, Ooh, I don't know.
Okay, Jenny. Can you steal this as you stealed it before? You stole Burton.
I'm guessing the air hostess.
No.
No.
Robin?
Not an idea. I know nothing about deep sea fishing.
Oh, honestly, you know. Dan. It's a Dan. Okay. The next one, as in Dan Erickson, the co-pilot. Fourth one. Should we, by process of elimination, be improving these? So let's start off again with Poppy. A Welsh port or a famous American naval captain, commander of the Lexington during the War of Independence. A Welsh port or a famous American naval captain, commander of the Lexington during the War of Independence.
Air hostess?
No. Jess?
Oh, this feels like Jeopardy. I don't know.
I I would have thought, you know, you, as our sole American here, you know, you should know who was the commander of the Lexington during the War of Independence.
I should. I have to brush up on my history. I have let my country down.
Lord, this is what comes of 3.5 years of Trump. Jenny.
The guy that wasn't English speaking, whose name I can't remember.
No. This means Robin will surely get it on the basis of a Welsh port.
Barry Lockridge.
Exactly, Barry Lockridge. 2-0 up. Robin working through the little boy, etc. Not as in boy, as in sea boy. Okay, back with yourself again, Poppy. Do not give despair. Still time to actually come back on this. A king of Macedonia who had a horse named Bucephalus. A king of Macedonia who had a horse named Bucephalus.
I'm going to go ahead and say the air hostess again.
No. I'll open it up and give Jess a clue here. He was the only person who actually had a pistol secreted upon his person in this particular thing. Who was this, Jess?
Is his name Alexander?
He's Alexander. Jessica gets on the board. Excellent. Okay, Jenny, your completely new one in this particular thing is the British leader of two important Antarctic expeditions to the South Pole. Now you've contradicted yourself twice there.
No. I said Scott, but then I thought, I don't know which character in the Giants was Scott.
Oh, you're a quarter of a point for that. Because, of course, Poppy, it refers to which character?
The air hostess?
No. Valerie Scott, the heiress. If only you hadn't said hostess and just said heiress, you would have been right. But never mind. And of course, the heiress being one of the reasons that Olivia de Havilland actually won an Academy Award. Finally, then, a famous 18th century American statesman, the capital of Bermuda, and the city which is the centre of the Canadian steel industry. Poppy?
The engineer.
No.
What?
Jessica.
A Canadian city?
A Canadian city, a famous 18th century American statesman. There's been a musical that Disney Plus are running about this character. Very popular musical in America and in the West End in the pre-COVID-19 days.
Is it Hamilton?
Are you asking, or is that a statement? Are you going with that?
Yes, what
is Betty Hamilton, and indeed, Poppy, Betty Hamilton was indeed the air hostess. If only you'd stuck with the air hostess, you would have actually scored and just switched away on that. So there we have it, proving that maybe the characters weren't as memorable as we actually thought in terms of Steve Burton, Betty Hamilton, Dan Erickson, Valerie Scott, Barry Lockridge, and Mark Wilson, and Alexander Fitzhugh, Land of the Giants, from that point of view. Robin, you are a winner, actually. Two glorious points, actually. You know, I think the Barry sort of took it into that, but well done on that sort of particular basis. Obviously, you carried it round well on that system.
Thank you, sir.
So, summations. I mean, we can't really look ahead to the series, and you know, there are obviously developments within that. Overall, Robin, I mean, you seem to think it was reasonably well done, apart from two bad examples of blue screen or green screen at the time.
Are we marking out of 10?
We are.
I would give this 8 out of 10 for imagination. It's a good production. I like the design of the ship. Irwin Allen always had really good ship designs. The only thing I can't understand is that red panel that did nothing but flash off and on where the passengers were sitting. I mean, how do you like to fly over the Atlantic with that just going off and on, red? I'll definitely give it an 8. Possibly this will get Paul Mount off my back. He's a big Land of the Giants fan. He's head writer for Starburst magazine, and he has warned me to be nice about it. I had toyed with the idea of perhaps reducing it by a point because they just rehashed the crash over and over and over in the series as to what they were doing. But no, I'll give this, the crash, 8 out of 10. If we revisit it, I might not be as even tempered.
Wow. Interesting enough, of course, the sequence that had Mark Wilson fiddling around in the back of the Spindrift used part of the set from the Jupiter 2 in Lost in Space.
Also, this is what I couldn't quite understand about the Spindrift. They were talking about the fuel. We're out of fuel. Mm. And check the fuel gauge. And whenever they said check the fuel gauge, it was like, how is the fuel gauge behind them?
Blinking lights, Robin. Blinking lights.
Behind them.
5,000 feet and still climbing.
Look where you're going.
Interesting enough, the little boy, the giant boy, appeared in several of Owen Allen's productions and in cameo roles, including something we'll probably be looking at in a few weeks' time, the first episode of Time Tunnel. Okay, 8 out of 10 for yourself. Jessica, what would you go for as far as the pilot episode of Land of the Giants, The Creche, is concerned? And you can give your mother's score as well in this as an aggregate, if you wish.
I would give it an 8 out of 10. I think my mom would probably give it a 9 out of 10, actually. I think she would enjoy it a lot. I thought it was really fun. I really liked the hiding in the egg carton and the part where they opened the door and there was just a cat there. That was great. But it reminded me a lot of The Twilight Zone with the episodes where they've had giants. But yeah, I think I would dock a couple stars for there just not being enough... I was having a hard time following which character was which, but otherwise it's very good.
So too many, and obviously Alexander Fitz, you just a boy, just a terrible sort of boy. I wasn't sure initially. I thought he sounds very Eastern European. I know Kurt Kasner obviously was it, but it just seemed unusual that he was a Navy man, then not a Navy man, then a con artist, and so on. But interesting, I think. And obviously, the last thing you want to do if you've got $1 million in your suitcase is to run around with it with a loosely fitting suitcase. Which enables the money to just flutter out all over the place. It's not a good look, Alexander. It's not good. Jenny, thoughts for yourself? Or scores from yourself?
I think I'd probably only give it about a 6, because, as I said,
agree,
because I thought that the... but I suppose, yeah, with Miri, though, I think probably because I like Star Trek and didn't think that was a great Star Trek episode, but this I thought that they were, as I said before, way out with the sort of time line, and I didn't think the characters were very good, but the sets were great, so yeah, I'd give it 6.
You may say way out with the timeline, but actually the 1980s were when it was the same era as Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea that was also set in that thing. There is a certain you could have had the Owen Allen universe all taking place in the 80s.
There's a few programs that are very out with the timeline, and I sort of think it's the 60s, and do they honestly think that in 20 years' time we're all going to be zooming to Los Angeles and London in rockets?
Or in 50 years' time we'll all be locked down doing radio shows via video phones.
Exactly.
Beyond me and Arthur C. Clarke, it would seem. Interesting whether we ever see an Owen Allen multiverse put together. And remember, of course, Jenny, we could be referring to our timeline. In the timeline of the Spindrift, which I often used to think was just somebody who actually spent unnecessarily, basically. Of course, that was something completely different as opposed to Spindrift. A different line comes to the fore. Poppy, your score.
I think I will agree with Jenny and give it a 6. I think it was enjoyable to watch, but I don't think I'd go for it again. And I think that a lot of the reasons I found it enjoyable were not meant to be funny. You know, it was funny that the cat just looked rubbish, and they weren't meaning for that to be part of the entertainment value. So I think that's why I'll give it a 6.
If it helps, Poppy, I had exactly the same response when we were doing an analysis with our film critic Richard Fitzwilliams recently on Master and Commander, which I thought, viewed 17 years after its original launch, is probably one of the most preposterously amusing films I've ever seen in terms of overacting and Russell Crowe, etc. Still a good movie for all that, but watch Master and Commander if you want to almost see how Adam West would have actually acted as Captain Jack Aubrey in a kind of Napoleonic naval battle scenario. Extraordinary. Still, that's by the by. And I'm going to go for an 8, actually, because I think overall, looking at all the variations, I think it had pluses and factors, including, of course, the awesome music by a gentleman, of course, who went on to do the Star Wars, Superman, Raiders of the Lost Ark themes, John Williams. And again, I think the music adds a huge amount to the series and gives it that kind of cinematic effect and feel.
But he did use an awful lot of cues from Lost in Space in the opening episode.
Plus, of course,
when they walk out before they see the giant car.
But it's all part of the same universe. I mean, the Robinsons might have already gone off. You know, they were using the Spindrift from that point of view. And yes, the giant cars and so on, obviously all impact on that. So that's the Land of the Giants episode wrapped up for Resonance Rewind. Next time round, of course, we are heading into the darker world of animation. And if you, I mean, obviously neither Jenny nor Jessica nor Poppy were actually present for the first episode of this particular series in which we reviewed Enter Batgirl, Exit Penguin. And I often think if you actually could, if you get a chance to watch that, which is online and via YouTube, etc., with The Killing Joke, in which the original comic is expanded by a whole new incarnation of Batgirl, it might be an interesting comparison from that point of view. So The Killing Joke is lined up for the next side of things. Have we answered all of our key questions? Yes, in terms of... Oh, yes, one final thing. Why was June the 12th, 1983, so significant? Apart from, obviously, the Spindrift's unfortunate departure into a magnetic anomaly when it was travelling from Los Angeles to London. Robin, you've got this, I'm sure.
No.
June the 12th, Irwin Allen's birthday. You see, Resonance Rewind, Irwin Allen, born June the 12th, 1916. As I said, he would have been 104 had he lived, but he hasn't. So he's up there, probably creating all sorts of things. And the pandemic is probably grist to his mill. He said, this is what we need. Jessica Burtis, Jenny Bill, Poppy Booth, Robin Pierce. Happy Resonance Rewinding.